were called jungle rot or jungle sores. Our own mail came up to us in canvas bags, usually with ammo and rations. It was of tremendous value in boosting sagging morale. On several occasions, I actually had to bend over my letters and read as rapidly as possible to shield them from the torrents of rain before the ink was smeared across the soggy paper and the writing became illegible. Most of us received letters from family and civilian friends, but occasionally we received letters from old Company K buddies who had returned to the States. Their early letters expressed relief over being back with family or with wine, women, and song. But later, the letters often became disturbingly bitter and filled with disillusionment. Some expressed a desire to return if they could get back into the old battalion. Considering the dangers and hardships those men had been through before they were sent home, and considering our situation in front of Shuri, the attitudes of our buddies who had returned stateside puzzled us. They expressed themselves in various ways, but the gist of their disillusionment was a feeling of alienation from everyone but their old comrades. Although there was gasoline and meat rationing back in the States, life was safe and easy. Plenty of people were ready to buy a Marine combat veteran wearing campaign ribbons and battle stars a drink or a beer anytime. But all the good life and luxury didn't seem to take the place of old friendships forged in combat. There was talk of war profiteers and able-bodied men who got easy duty at the expense of others. Some letters said simply that folks back in the States just don't understand what the hell it's all about, because they have had it so easy. I heard more than one buddy express the opinion, as we sat in the mud, that civilians would understand if the Japanese or the Germans bombed an American city. Some men thought that would have been a good idea if no American civilians got killed, just scared. But nobody wanted it to be his hometown. It was hard to believe that some of our old friends who had wanted so much to return home actually were writing us that they thought of volunteering again for overseas duty. Some actually did. They had had enough of war, but they had greater difficulty adjusting to civilians or to comfortable stateside military posts. We were unable to understand their attitudes until we ourselves returned home and tried to comprehend people who griped because America wasn't perfect, or their coffee wasn't hot enough, or they had to stand in line and wait for a train or bus. Our buddies who had gone back had been greeted enthusiastically, as those of us who survived were received later on. But the folks back home didn't, and in retrospect, couldn't have been expected to, understand what we had experienced, what in our minds seemed to set us apart forever from anyone who hadn't been in combat. We didn't want to indulge in self-pity. We just wished that people back home could understand how lucky they were and stop complaining about trivial inconveniences. Siegfried Sassoon, an English combat infantry officer and poet in World War I, experienced the same feeling when he returned home. He summed it up in the following verse. "You smug-faced crowds with kindling eye, who cheer when soldier lads march by, sneak home and pray you'll never know the hell where youth and laughter go." The poet might just as well have been referring to Peleliu, or to the mud fields in front of Shuri, as to France in World War I. Some of the younger replacements who came to us then had trouble adjusting, and not just to the shelling. That was enough to shake up the strongest veteran, but they were utterly dismayed by our horrible surroundings. Numerous Marine replacements for combat units on Okinawa never had their names added to their unit's muster rolls because they got hit before notice of their transfer from their replacement draft to the combat unit ever reached headquarters, U.S. Marine Corps. so they were listed on the casualty rolls as members of various replacement drafts. It was also common, throughout the campaign, for replacements to get hit before we even knew their names. They came up confused, frightened, and hopeful, got wounded or killed, and went right back to the rear on the route by which they had come, shocked, bleeding, or stiff. They were forlorn figures, coming up to the meat grinder and going right back out of it like homeless waifs, unknown and faceless to us, like unread books on a shelf. They never belonged to the company or made any friends before they got hit. Of course, those replacements who got hit right away with the million-dollar wound were actually fortunate. Our food usually consisted of a cold can of sea rations and, rarely, a canteen cup of hot coffee. When we could brew it up, it was a treat. It was difficult to warm anything with our little heat tablets because of the almost constant rain. Sometimes, I had to hunch over and shield a can of sea ration stew from the rain, because the can would fill up with rainwater as fast as I spooned the cold stew into my mouth. We ate only because hunger forced us to do so. No other stimulus could have forced me to eat when my nostrils were so saturated with the odor of decay that I frequently felt sick. I ate little during that period, but drank hot coffee or bouillon at every opportunity. The constant rain caused our weapons to rust. Most of us lined the holsters for our 45 automatic pistols with the green plastic covers we were issued. These came in long, sleeve-like pieces and could be placed over carbines, rifles, and Tommy guns. We kept a plastic hood draped over our mortar when it wasn't in use. This plastic cover was issued to be placed over ourselves while crouching down to avoid being sprayed with mustard gas, should that weapon have been used by the Japanese. We kept our weapons heavily oiled and actually had little trouble with them considering the battlefield conditions. Field sanitation was non-existent because of the shelling and the mud. Each man simply used a grenade canister or ammo carton and threw his own waste out into the already foul mud around his foxhole. By day, the battlefield was a horrible scene, but by night, it became the most terrible of nightmares. Star shells and flares illuminated the area throughout the nights, but were interspersed with moments of chilling, frightening blackness. Sleep was almost impossible in the mud and cold rain, but sometimes I wrapped my wet poncho around me and dozed off for brief periods while my foxhole mate was on watch and bailing out the hole. One usually had to attempt sleep while sitting or crouching in the foxhole. As usual, we rarely ventured out of our foxholes at night, unless to care for wounded or to get ammunition. When a flare or star shell lighted the area, everyone froze just as he was, then moved during the brief periods of darkness. When the area lighted up with that eerie greenish light, the big raindrops sparkled like silver shafts as they slanted downward. During a strong wind, they looked as though they were being driven along almost horizontal to the deck. The light reflected off the dirty water in the craters and off the helmets and weapons of the living and the dead. I cataloged in my mind the position of every feature on the surrounding terrain. There was no vegetation, so my list consisted of mounds and dips in the terrain, foxholes of my comrades, craters, corpses, and knocked-out tanks and Amtraks. We had to know where everyone, living and dead, was located. If one of us fired at an enemy infiltrating or on a raid, he needed to know where his comrades were so as not to hit them. The position and posture of every corpse was important because infiltrating Japanese also would freeze when illuminating shells lit up, so they might go unnoticed among the dead. The longer we stayed in the area, the more unending the night seemed to become. I reached the state where I would awake abruptly from my semi-sleep, and if the area was lit up, note with confidence my buddy scanning the terrain for any hostile sign. I would glance about, particularly behind us, for trouble. Finally, before we left the area, I frequently jerked myself up into a state in which I was semi-awake during periods between starshells. I imagined Marine Dead had risen up and were moving silently about the area. I suppose these were nightmares, and I must have been more asleep than awake, or just dumbfounded by fatigue. Possibly, they were hallucinations, but they were strange and horrible. The pattern was always the same. The dead got up slowly out of their waterlogged craters or off the mud and, with stooped shoulders and dragging feet, wandered around aimlessly, their lips moving as though trying to tell me something. I struggled to hear what they were saying. They seemed agonized by pain and despair. I felt they were asking me for help. The most horrible thing was that I felt unable to aid them. At that point, I invariably became wide awake and felt sick and half crazed by the horror of my dream. I would gaze out intently to see if the silent figures were still there, but saw nothing. When a flare lit up, all was stillness and desolation, each corpse in its usual place. Among the craters off the ridge, to the west was a scattering of marine corpses. Just beyond the right edge of the end foxhole, the ridge fell away steeply to the flat, muddy ground. Next to the base of the ridge, almost directly below me, was a partially flooded crater, about 3 feet in diameter and probably 3 feet deep. In this crater was the body of a Marine, whose grisly visage has remained disturbingly clear in my memory. If I close my eyes, he is as vivid as though I had seen him only yesterday. The pathetic figure sat with his back toward the enemy and leaned against the south edge of the crater. His head was cocked, and his helmet rested against the side of the crater so that his face, or what remained of it, looked straight up at me. His knees were flexed and spread apart. Across his thighs, still clutched in his skeletal hands, was his rusting BAR. Canvas leggings were laced neatly along the sides of his calves and over his boondockers. His ankles were covered with muddy water, but the toes of his boondockers were visible above the surface. His dungarees, helmet, cover, and 782 gear appeared new. They were neither mud-spattered nor faded. I was confident that he had been a new replacement. Every aspect of that big man looked much like a Marine taking 10 on maneuvers before the order to move out again. He apparently had been killed early in the attacks against the Half Moon, before the rains began. Beneath his helmet brim, I could see the visor of a green cotton fatigue cap. Under that cap were the most ghastly, skeletal remains I had ever seen, and I had already seen too many. Every time I looked over the edge of that foxhole, down into that crater, that half-gone face leered up at me with a sardonic grin. It was as though he was mocking our pitiful efforts to hang on to life in the face of the constant violent death that had cut him down. Or maybe he was mocking the folly of the war itself. I am the harvest of man's stupidity. I am the fruit of the Holocaust. I prayed like you to survive. But look at me now. It is over for us who are dead, but you must struggle and will carry the memories all your life. People back home will wonder why you can't forget. During the day, I sometimes watched big raindrops splashing into the crater around that corpse, and remembered how as a child I had been fascinated by raindrops splashing around a large green frog as he sat in a ditch near home. My grandmother had told me that elves made little splashes like that, and they were called water babies. So I sat in my foxhole and watched the water babies splashing around the green dungaree-clad corpse. What an unlikely combination. The war had turned the water babies into little ghouls that danced around the dead instead of little elves dancing around a peaceful bullfrog. A man had little to occupy his mind at Shuri. Just sit in muddy misery and fear. Tremble through the shellings and let his imagination go where it would. One of the very few humorous incidents I saw during those terrible days before Shuri occurred toward the end of the awful stalemate. Two Marines from the other mortar squad were dug in to the left of my gun pit. One morning, at the first pale light of dawn, I heard a commotion in their foxhole. I could hear a poncho being flung aside as someone began thrashing around. There were grunts and swearing. I strained my eyes through the steaming rain and brought the Tommy gun up to my shoulder. From all indications, one or more Japanese had slipped up on the weary occupants of the foxhole, and they were locked in a life-and-death struggle. But I could do nothing but wait and alert other men around us. The commotion grew louder, and I could barely make out two dark figures struggling in the foxhole. I was utterly helpless to aid a buddy in distress, because I couldn't identify who was Marine and who was Japanese. None of us dared to leave his own foxhole and approach the two. The enemy soldier must have already knifed one of the Marines and was grappling with the other, I thought. The dark figures rose up, standing toe-to-toe. They leaned into each other and exchanged blows with their fists. Everyone's eyes were fixed on the struggling figures, but could see little in the semi-darkness and pouring rain. The mumblings and swearing became louder and understandable, and we heard, "You dumb jerk! Give me that range card! It's mine!" I recognized the voice of a man who had come into Company K before Okinawa. "No, it's not. It's mine. You better give me it. I don't take no crap from nobody." The latter was the familiar voice of Santos, a Peleliu veteran. We all started in surprise. "Hey, you guys, what the hell's going on over there?" growled an NCO. The two struggling figures recognized his voice and immediately stopped hitting each other. "You two eight balls," the NCO said, as he went over to them. "It would have served you right if we had shot you both. We figured a nip had got in your foxhole." Each of the two battlers protested that the other was the cause of all the trouble. The light was good by then, and some of us went over to their foxhole to investigate. "What's all the row about?" I asked. "This, by God, nothing but this," snarled the NCO, as he glared at the two sheepish occupants of the foxhole and handed me a range card. I was puzzled why two Marines would squabble over a range card, but when I looked at the card, I saw it was special and unique. Impressed on it, in lipstick, was the ruby-red imprint of a woman's lips. The men had found the unique card in a canister while breaking out ammo for the guns the previous afternoon and had argued all night about who would keep it. Toward dawn, they came to blows over it. The NCO continued to chew them out as I handed the card back to him and returned to my foxhole. We all got a good laugh out of the episode. I often wondered what that woman back in the ammunition factory in the States would have thought about the results of her efforts to add a little morale booster for us in a canister of mortar ammo. During the last few days of May, we received several small but vicious counterattacks from the Japanese soldiers, who had been occupying the caves in the reverse slope of Half Moon's left-hand arm. One morning, we got a message that a large number of enemy was massing behind the crescent. I was ordered to leave the OP and return to the gun pit in preparation for a big fire mission. I moved down the ridge and across the reeking, shell-pocked wasteland to the gun pits without mishap. Once there, we squared away the 360mm mortars to fire on the reverse slope of the left crescent arm. The firing pattern of the mortars was arranged to box in the Japanese and prevent their escape while our three guns shelled the area heavily in an attempt to wipe them out. Consequently, we had to fire rapid fire, searching and traversing the target area. The ammo carriers were kept busy breaking out more HE shells, but I was so busy on my mortar, I didn't have time to notice them. The tube, barrel, became intensely hot. We wrapped a dungaree jacket around the lower half of it, and one of the ammo carriers poured helmets full of water taken from a shell crater over the cloth to cool the steaming barrel, while we continued rapid fire. We fired I don't know how many hundreds of shells before the order came to cease firing. My ears rang. I was exhausted and had a roaring headache. Beside each of the three gun pits was a huge stack of empty HE canisters and ammo crates from the large number of shells we had fired. We were anxious to know the results of our firing, but our observers couldn't see the target area because it was on the reverse slope of the ridge. A few days later, when our regiment went forward in the attack, we didn't move through the target area, so we still didn't see the effects of the fire mission. But one company KNCO, who did see the area, told us that he had counted more than 200 enemy dead, who apparently had been trapped and killed by our fire. I assume he was right, because after our barrage, the Japanese ceased activity along the ridge. Shuri. The rain began to slacken, and rumors spread that we would attack soon. We also heard that the main enemy force had withdrawn from the Shuri line, but the Japanese had left a strong rear guard to fight to the death, so we could expect no signs of weakness. The Japanese had been spotted retreating from Shuri under cover of the bad weather. Our naval guns, artillery, heavy mortars, and even a few airplanes had thrown a terrific bombardment into them. But withdrawal or not, Shuri wasn't going to fall easily. We anticipated a hard fight once the weather cleared. On a quiet day or two before the 5th Marines moved out for the big push against Shuri, several Marines from the Graves Registration Section came into our area to collect the dead. Those dead already on stretchers presented no problem, but the corpses rotting in shell craters and in the mud were another matter. We sat on our helmets and gloomily watched the Graves Registration people trying to do their macabre duty. They each were equipped with large rubber gloves and a long pole with a stiff flap attached to the end, like some huge spatula. They would lay a poncho next to a corpse, then place the poles under the body and roll it over onto the poncho. It sometimes took several tries, and we winced when a corpse fell apart. The limbs or head had to be shoved onto the poncho like bits of garbage. We felt sympathy for the Graves Registration men. With the corpses being moved, the stench of rotting flesh became worse, if possible, than ever before. Apparently, the enemy had withdrawn guns and troops from Shuri to the extent that their shelling of our area had all but stopped. A miserable drizzling rain commenced again. Almost out on my feet with fatigue, I decided to take advantage of the quiet. I unfolded an unused stretcher, set it on some boards, lay down on my back, and covered my head and body with my poncho. It was the first time in 2 months since leaving my canvas rack aboard ship on 1 April D-Day that I had been able to lie down on anything but hard ground or mud. The canvas stretcher felt like a deluxe bed, and my poncho shielded all by my mud-caked boondockers and ankles from the rain. For the first time in about 10 days, I fell into a deep sleep. How long I slept, I don't know, but after a while, I became aware of being lifted upward. At first, I thought I was dreaming, but then I awoke fully and realized someone had picked up the stretcher. Throwing the poncho away from me, I sprang off the stretcher, spun around, and saw 2 clean, neatly shaven Marines looking at me in utter astonishment. Several of my grimy buddies squatting on their muddy helmets nearby began to laugh. The 2 strangers were Graves Registration men. They had picked up the stretcher, thinking I was just another poncho-covered corpse. It never occurred to them that instead, I was just a weary Marine trying to catch a nap on a comfortable stretcher who had covered himself to keep off the rain. They grinned when they realized what had happened. I accused my buddies of telling the 2 men to pick up my stretcher, But they only laughed and asked why my nap had ended so abruptly. I was left with an eerie feeling from the incident, but my buddies enjoyed the joke thoroughly. Dawn broke, clearly without rain, on 28 May, and we prepared to attack later in the morning. About 10:15, we attacked southward against long-range mortar and machine gun fire. We were elated that the opposition was so light and that the sun was shining. We actually advanced several hundred yards that day, quite an accomplishment in that sector. Moving through the mud was still difficult, but we were all glad to get out of the stinking, half-flooded garbage pit around the half moon. That night we learned that we would continue the attack the next day by moving directly against the Shuri Ridge. About mid-morning on 29 May, 3-5 attacked the Shuri with Company L in the lead and Companies K and I following closely. Earlier in the morning, Company A, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, had attacked eastward into the rain of Shuri Castle and had raised the Confederate flag. When we learned that the flag of the Confederacy had been hoisted over the very heart and soul of Japanese resistance, all of us Southerners cheered loudly. The Yankees among us grumbled, and the Westerners didn't know what to do. Later, we learned that the stars and stripes that had flown over Guadalcanal were raised over Shuri Castle, a fitting tribute to the men of the 1st Marine Division who had the honor of being first into the Japanese citadel. We all were filled with a sense of accomplishment that night as we dug in somewhere around Shuri Castle. We in the ranks were well aware of its strategic importance to the progress of the campaign. Although the whole place was in ruins, we could still see that the area around Shuri Castle had been impressive and picturesque before its destruction by the incessant U.S. bombardment. Shuri Castle itself was a mess, and I couldn't tell much about its former appearance. It had been an ancient stone building surrounded by a moat and what appeared to have been terraces and gardens. As we picked our way through the rubble, I looked at the terraced stonework and shattered blackened tree stumps. I thought it must have been a pretty place once. We dug in that night with the knowledge that even though we were at last in Shuri Castle, there were strong, entrenched Japanese still north of us in Wanna Draw, east of us, and south of us. The lines were terribly confused to many of us in the ranks, and we assumed that the enemy could come at us from almost any direction. But they remained quiet during the night, except for the usual raiders. We attacked again the next day and got shelled badly. I was totally confused as to where we were for several days and can't clarify it now in my mind, even after careful study of the notes and references at my disposal. At dusk, on one of those last few days of May, we moved into a muddy, slippery ridge and were told to dig in along the crest. One of the three 60mm mortar squads was to set up its gun down behind the ridge, but my squad and the remaining squad were ordered to dig in along the ridge crest and to function as riflemen during the night. The weather turned bad again, and it started raining. Mac, our mortar section leader, was nowhere to be seen. But Duke, who had been our section leader on Peleliu, and who was by then leading the battalion's 81mm mortar platoon, came up to take charge. He ordered an NCO to have us dig two-man foxholes 5 yards apart along the crest of the ridge. My buddy went off down the ridge to draw ammo and chow while I prepared to dig. The ridge was about 100 feet high, quite steep, and we were on a narrow crest. Several discarded Japanese packs, helmets, and other gear lay scattered along the crest. From the looks of the muddy soil, the place had been shelled heavily for a long time. The ridge was a putrid place. Our artillery must have killed Japanese there earlier because the air was foul with the odor of rotting flesh. It was just like being back at Half Moon Hill. Off toward our front, to the south, I had only a dim view through the gathering gloom and curtain of rain of the muddy valley below. The men digging in on both sides of me cursed the stench and the mud. I began moving the heavy, sticky clay mud with my entrenching shovel to shape out the extent of the foxhole before digging deeper. Each shovelful had to be knocked off the spade because it stuck like glue. I was thoroughly exhausted and thought my strength wouldn't last from one sticky shovelful to the next. Kneeling on the mud, I had dug the hole no more than 6 or 8 inches deep when the odor of rotting flesh got worse. There was nothing to do but continue to dig, so I closed my mouth and inhaled with short, shallow breaths. Another spadeful of soil out of the hole released a mass of wriggling maggots that came welling up as though those beneath were pushing them out. I cursed and told the NCO as he came by what a mess I was digging into. "You heard him. He said put the holes 5 yards apart." In disgust, I drove the spade into the soil, scooped out the insects, and threw them down the front of the ridge. The next stroke of the spade unearthed buttons and scraps of cloth from a Japanese army jacket buried in the mud, and another mass of maggots. I kept on doggedly. With the next thrust, metal hit the breastbone of a rotting Japanese corpse. I gazed down in horror and disbelief as the metal scraped a clean track through the mud along the dirty, whitish bone and cartilage with ribs attached. The shovel skidded into the rotting abdomen with a squishing sound. The odor nearly overwhelmed me as I rocked back on my heels. I began choking and gagging as I yelled in desperation, "I can't dig in here! There's a dead nip here!" The NCO came over, looked down at my problem and at me, and growled, "You heard him. He said put the holes 5 yards apart." "How the hell can I dig a foxhole through a dead nip?" I protested. Just then Duke came along the ridge and said, "What's the matter, Sledgehammer?" I pointed to the partially exhumed corpse. Duke immediately told the NCO to have me dig a little to the side, away from the rotting remains. I thanked Duke and glared at the NCO. How I managed not to vomit during that vile experience, I don't know. Perhaps my senses and nerves had been so dulled by the constant foulness for so long that nothing could evoke any other response but to cry out and move back. I soon had a proper foxhole dug to one side of the site of my first attempt. A few spades full of mud thrown back into that excavation did little to reduce the horrid odor. My buddy returned, and we began to square away our gear for the coming light. There was some small arms fire to our left, but all was quiet around us. Duke was down at the foot of the ridge, behind us with a map in his hand. He called us to come down for a critique and a briefing on the next day's attack. Glad to leave the stinking foxhole, I got up and carefully started down the slippery ridge. My buddy rose, took one step down the ridge, slipped, and fell. He slid on his belly all the way to the bottom, like a turtle sliding off a log. I reached the bottom to see him stand erect with his arms partially extended and look down at his chest and belt with a mixed expression of horror, revulsion, and disbelief. He was, of course, muddy from the slide. But that was the least of it. White, fat maggots tumbled and rolled off his cartridge belt, pockets, and folds of his dungaree jacket and trousers. I picked up a stick and handed him another. Together, we scraped the vile insect larvae off his reeking dungarees. That Marine was a Gloucester veteran with whom I had often shared a hole on Peleliu in Okinawa. He was as tough and as hard as any man I ever knew. But that slide was almost too much for him. I thought he was going to scream or crack up. Having to wallow in war's putrefaction was almost more than the toughest of us could bear. He shook himself like a wet dog, however, cursed, and threw down the stick when we got him scraped free of maggots. Duke's group of 8 to 10 Marines showed their sympathy for my buddy and their appreciation of the vileness of his accident. Muddy, bearded, and red-eyed with fatigue, Duke called our attention to the map, and that helped us focus on other subjects. He showed us where we were, and told us some of the plans for the next day's attack, which was supposed to break completely through the Shuri line. I was so revolted and sickened by what had just happened and so weary that I didn't remember much of what he told us. It is a pity in retrospect, because that briefing was the only time in my combat experience that an officer ever showed a group of privates a map of the battlefield and explained recent events and future attack plans. Usually an NCO simply relayed the word to us. We then followed orders as they were given, rarely knowing what was going on. We never knew why Duke held the little critique that night, whether he was ordered to do so or not. I suspect he did it on his own. He realized we wanted to know and understand our role in the overall plan. It was a historic time, and we were participating in events of key importance to the American effort on Okinawa. All eyes were on Shuri. My buddies and I were key participants at a critical juncture in one of the most epic land battles of World War II, and we were having our tiny role in that battle explained. Duke asked if there were any questions. A few were asked, which he answered clearly. I maintained my condition of near stupefaction through it all. Then we slowly climbed back up the filthy ridge after he dismissed us. That night the rain came down in torrents. It was without exaggeration the most terrific deluge I've ever seen. The wind blew fiercely, slashing the rain horizontally across the crest of the ridge, and stinging our faces and hands. The star shells burst, but gave little illumination, because they were snatched away immediately by the unseen hand of the gale. Visibility was limited to about 6 feet. We couldn't see our buddies in their foxholes on either side of us. What a terrible night to grapple with Japanese infiltrators or a counterattack, I thought to myself all night long. Considerable machine gun fire, bursts of rifle fire, and grenade explosions erupted throughout the night a short way down the line to our left. But all was mercifully quiet, albeit tense, in our immediate area. Next morning, I realized why we weren't molested by the enemy as the men to our left had been. For a considerable distance to our right and left, the ridge fell away, almost perpendicularly to the valley below. The Japanese simply couldn't crawl up the slick surface.
In the latter days of May, while the Japanese held on to the center of their line around Shuri, the U.S. Army divisions to the east and the 6th Marine Division to the west around Naha finally made progress to the south. Their combined movements threatened to envelop the main Japanese defense forces in the center. Thus, the enemy had to withdraw. By dawn on the 30th of May, most of the Japanese 32nd Army had departed the Shuri line, leaving only rear guards to cover their retreat. In the 61 days of fighting on Okinawa after D-Day, an estimated 62,548 Japanese soldiers had lost their lives, and 465 had been captured. American dead numbered 5,309. 23,909 had been wounded, and 346 were missing in action. It wasn't over yet.
Chapter 14. Beyond Shuri. We pushed past Shuri over some muddy hills in the Army zone of action and came across a group of about 20 Japanese prisoners. Each man was stripped except for a G-string. They stood barefooted in the mud alongside a trail winding along the slope of the barren hill. Several dirty and battle-weary Army infantrymen guarded them. The captured enemy had been ordered by an interpreter, Army Lieutenant, to stand off the trail so Company's K column could pass. We slipped and slid, wearily toward the sound of firing up ahead. A grizzled rifleman in front of me and I had been cursing the mud and exchanging remarks about how glad we were to be past Shuri. Suddenly, a Japanese prisoner stepped in front of my friend, blocking his way. "Get out of the way, you crazy bastard," growled the Marine. The soldier folded his arms calmly, raised his chin, and displayed a picture of arrogance. My buddy and I heated up fast. He pushed the Japanese backward and sent him sprawling into the mud. The enemy soldier sprang up quickly and assumed his former position. "What's that crazy bastard doing?" I yelled, as I dropped my mortar ammo bag and reached for my .45 pistol. My buddy unslung his rifle, grasped it by the stock with his left hand and by the pistol grip with his right hand. He planted his muddy feet firmly on the trail, flexed his knees, and growled, "Get out of my way, you bastard." Other Marines behind us had halted when we did. Seeing what was happening, they started cursing the Japanese. "What's the holdup? Move out!" someone behind us yelled. The Army First Lieutenant, he was actually wearing his silver bars on his collars, clean-shaven and spotless except for muddy combat boots, came along the column to ascertain the problem. Seeing my buddy's stance and realizing he might soon have one less prisoner, he said, "You can't mistreat these men. They are prisoners of war. According to the Geneva Code, POWs must be treated humanely." He looked desperate. The whole column of muddy, raggedy-ass Marines glared at and cursed the prisoners strung out alongside us on the trail. "Screw the Geneva Code. If that slant-eyed son of a bitch don't move out of my way, I'll give him a vertical butt stroke in his big mouth and knock out every one of them goddamn buck teeth." My buddy slowly moved his rifle back and forth, and the enemy soldier's arrogant expression began to fade. The Army lieutenant knew he had a bad problem on his hands, and he obviously didn't know how to solve it. It was commonly said that Marines rarely took prisoners. A couple of GI riflemen of the prisoner guard detail stood by relaxed and grinned their endorsement of our sentiments. They obviously had been in the meat grinder long enough to have no more love for the Japanese than we did. The lieutenant obviously wasn't one of their officers, but from some rear echelon outfit. Just then, one of our officers hurried up from the rear of the column. The Army lieutenant was mighty relieved to see him and explained the situation. Our officers went over and quietly told my buddy to get back into ranks. He then told the Army language officer that if he didn't get his prisoners out of the way, he, our officer, couldn't guarantee that some of them wouldn't get hurt. The Army officer spoke kindly in Japanese to the POWs, and they all stepped farther back away from the trail, giving us plenty of room. The language officer acted and sounded more like an elementary school teacher giving little children directions than an officer giving orders to a bunch of tough Japanese soldiers. During the whole episode, most of the Japanese never appeared afraid, merely chagrined or ashamed because they had acted disgracefully by surrendering. Perhaps the one who acted so arrogantly thought that one last act of defiance would soothe his conscience somewhat. Most Americans at the time couldn't comprehend the Japanese determination to win or fight to the death. To the Japanese, surrender was the ultimate disgrace. We didn't feel that POWs should be mistreated or handled roughly, but neither did we feel that one should be allowed to block our path and get away with the act. My view, that some language officers were often overly solicitous about the comfort of prisoners and unduly courteous to them, was shared by other infantrymen in the meat grinder. We were too familiar with the sight of helpless wounded Americans lying flat on their backs and on stretchers, getting shot by Japanese snipers while we struggled to evacuate them. After the breakthrough, we moved rapidly through areas where the opposition was light or absent. Our supply lines, communications, and casualty evacuation had a difficult time keeping up with us because the mud was still such a serious problem. Although the rain fell less frequently, it hadn't ceased. As our column moved along the base of a road embankment on one occasion, a Marine walking along the road above us, carrying a field telephone and a small roll of wire, shouted down and asked for the identity of our unit. His buddy followed him along the road, at a little distance carrying a roll of wire. These men were clean-shaven and neat. They looked suspiciously like rear echelon people to us. "Hey, what outfit you guys in?" shouted the first man up on the road. "K-35," I yelled. His buddy behind him asked him, "What outfit did he say?" "K-35, whatever the hell that means." The effect on us was instant and dramatic. Men who had paid little attention to what seemed a routine inquiry looked angrily up at the man. I flushed with anger. My unit and I had been insulted. The mortar man next to me threw down his ammo bag and started up the embankment. "I'll show you what the hell it means, you rear echelon son of a bitch! I'm gonna whip your ass!" I wasn't given to brawling. The Japanese provided me with all the excitement and fighting I wanted. But I lost my head completely. I threw down my ammo bag and started up the embankment. Other mortarmen started up too. "What's the dope?" I heard a man back along the column shout. "That rear echelon bastard up there cussed K Company," someone answered. Immediately, other Company K men started up the bank. The two men up on the road looked utterly bewildered as they saw bearded, muddy Marine infantrymen cursing, grounding their weapons, dropping their loads, and surging angrily up the embankment. One of our officers and a couple of NCOs saw what had happened and rushed up ahead of us. The officer turned and yelled, "You people get back in ranks on the double! Move, move!" We stopped, each of us knowing that to disobey orders invited severe disciplinary action. The two men on the road had become frightened, and we saw them hustling along the road to the rear. They looked back anxiously several times to see whether they were being followed. We must have been an angry, menacing-looking bunch from their viewpoint. I suspect those two Marines knew the real meaning and essence of esprit de corps after that experience. We picked up our weapons and gear and moved out again below the road, only to halt shortly. The officers consulted their maps, held a critique, and decided that place was as good as any for the company to leave the muddy low ground, go up the bank, and take advantage of the coral-surfaced road, probably the east-west Naha-Yunabaru Highway, a segment of which our regiment captured about then. We moved up onto the road, took off our gear, and settled onto the side of a large ridge with a wide grass and tree-covered crest. Okinawan burial vaults and emplacements lay all along the slope of the ridge, but the Japanese hadn't left many men to defend it. However, they gave a good account of themselves before being wiped out. Toward dusk, I was examining a Japanese 75mm dual-purpose gun, which they had abandoned in perfect condition. Several of us had a lot of fun turning its cranks and wheels, which we didn't understand, but which moved the big barrel up and down, right and left. Our play was interrupted by the shriek of several enemy artillery shells that exploded up on the ridge crest near a group of Company K men. "Corpsmen!" We raced up onto the ridge, hoping no more shells came in, but wondering who was hit and knowing we might be needed to help with the casualties. We could see the smoke from the shells and the Marines scurrying around to aid the casualties and to disperse. In the gathering twilight, I ran up to a little knot of Marines bending over a casualty. To my dismay, the wounded Marine was good-natured, cigar-chewing Joe Lambert, a demolitions expert I had known so long. I knelt beside him and was distressed to see that he had multiple wounds from shell fragments in his body. The men had eased a poncho under Lambert and were preparing to carry him down the ridge for evacuation. I wished him luck, made the usual jokes about not being too romantic with the nurses on the hospital ship, and asked him to drink a beer and think of me when he got stateside. The usual comments one made to a badly wounded friend who had little chance. Lambert looked up at me in the gathering darkness, with the stump of an unlighted cigar clenched in his teeth. He said, with irony in his voice. Sledgehammer, ain't this a hell of a thing? A man been in the company as long as me, and have to get carried out on a poncho. I made some feeble attempts to comfort him. I knew he was going to die, and I wanted to cry. Wish I could light that cigar for you, Cobber, but the smoking lamp is out. That's okay, Sledgehammer. One of those good-looking nurses will light it for you, I said, as they picked up the poncho and started off down the slope of the ridge with him. I stood up and looked at a nearby group of beautiful pines silhouetted against the darkening sky. The wind blew their fresh scent into my face, and I thought how much like southern pine it smelled. But poor, brave Lambert would never get back home again. I was thankful that when his luck finally ran out and he was fatally wounded, it happened on a high, clear, grassy ridge crest near a clump of fragrant pines, and not back in the stinking muck of the quagmire around Shuri. Corporal Lambert was a great favorite in Company K. Any of us who had fought on Peleliu's Bloody Nose Ridge had seen him numerous times, standing above some Japanese cave, swinging a satchel charge of explosives on a rope until he got it just right, then releasing the rope and yelling, "Fire in the hole!" just before the muffled explosion. He would grin, then climb down and rejoin us, wringing wet with sweat from his face to his boondockers. He would relight his cigar, which served in turn as a lighter for his satchel charge fuses, and discuss the damage done to the cave. He was big, round-faced, and jovial. Rumor said that he had been scheduled to return to the States after Peleliu, but refused because he wanted to remain with Company K. Not long after he was carried out, we learned that Lambert had died. It's one of the war's many personal tragedies that he was killed after having served so long and so bravely. The next day, we moved out into a wide valley below the ridge. We saw Japanese equipment and dead on several roads destroyed by the big U.S. bombardment the last week of May when the enemy had evacuated Shuri. We also encountered numerous Japanese supply dumps. Most of the food and rations didn't suit our tastes. The Japanese iron rations, which I had seen first in gauze sacks on Peleliu, tasted like dog biscuits. But I found several cans of preserved Japanese deep-sea scallops, which were delicious. Several cans of these stored in my pack were a welcome change from C&K rations. We made one rapid advance across a wide grassy valley, only to be halted by snipers in some rocks on the crest of the opposite ridge. We set up the guns, registered in on the areas where snipers were, and began firing. Stretcher teams came and went up and down the slope of the open ridge. Four of us were ordered off for a stretcher team to pick up a corpsman who had been hit by sniper fire. We went up the gently sloping, grass-covered ridge and came to the dock. Another stretcher team passed us, carrying the Marine who the doc had been tending when he himself was wounded. The Marine had been shot by a sniper, and the corpsman had come to administer medical aid. While he was working over the wounded Marine, a Japanese shot him in the thigh. Although wounded painfully, he continued to work on his patient. Then, the sniper had shot Doc in the other thigh. As we arrived, he cautioned us to be careful, or we would get hit too. We quickly got him on a stretcher and took off as fast as possible. Doc was a fairly tall, well-built man, larger than any of us. We carried him a long distance, down the ridge and across the wide valley to a steep-sided ditch spanned by a footbridge. An ambulance jeep was waiting on the other side of the footbridge. We were all nearly exhausted from the exertions and lack of sleep of the past 2 weeks, and it was quite a struggle. Twice wounded though he was, he kept insisting we stop and rest for a while. But we four felt obligated to get him to the jeep and evacuate it as soon as possible. Finally, we agreed to stop for a breather. Setting the stretcher down, we fell out flat on the grass, panting for breath. Doc talked to us calmly, admonishing us to take it easy and not to overexert ourselves. I felt ashamed. That unselfish, dedicated corpsman was more concerned because we were so tired from carrying him out than he was with his own wounds. We picked up the stretcher and got to the ditch. There on the bank, I saw a bush with several small red tomatoes. I managed to grab 3 or 4 tomatoes and put them on the stretcher as we got Doc across the narrow footbridge. I told him to eat them, that they'd make him feel better. He thanked me, but said we should eat them, because he would get good chow in the hospital. Who should walk around the jeep, just as we were loading our corpsman, but Doc Arrogant, notorious for painful shots on Pavuvu? "I'll take those," he said, reaching for the tomatoes. "The hell you say?" I exclaimed, snatching them out of his hand. One of my buddies went up to him and said, "You bastard! You'd take candy from a baby, wouldn't you?" Arrogant looked surly, turned around, and went back around the jeep. Our doc handed me the tomatoes and insisted we eat them. We said we would, and wished him luck, as the jeep bumped off to the rear. We recrossed the footbridge and fell exhausted onto the grass. We had a smoke, divided up the juicy little tomatoes, cussed Doc Arrogant, and voiced our admiration for all other corpsmen. On 4 June, we moved rapidly southward, through open country, in a torrential rain. Although the opposition was sporadic, we still had to check out all the houses, huts, and former Japanese emplacements. While searching a small hut, I came across an old Okinawan woman, seated on the floor, just inside the doorway. Taking no chances, I held my Thompson ready and motioned to her to get up and come out. She remained on the floor, but bowed her old gray head and held her gnarled hands toward me, palms down, to show the tattoos on the backs of her hands, indicating she was Okinawan. "No, Nippon," she said slowly, shaking her head as she looked up at me with a weary expression that bespoke of much physical pain. She then opened her ragged blue kimono and pointed to a wound in the lower left side of her abdomen. It was an old wound, probably caused by shell or bomb fragments. It was an awful sight. A large area around the scabbed over gash was discolored and terribly infected with gangrene. I gasped in dismay. I guessed that such a severe infection in the abdominal region was surely fatal. The old woman closed her kimono. She reached up gently, took the muzzle of my Tommy, and slowly moved it so as to direct it between her eyes. She then released the weapon's barrel and motioned vigorously for me to pull the trigger. "Oh no," I thought. "This old soul, in such agony, she actually wants me to put her out of her misery." I lifted my Tommy, slung it over my shoulder, shook my head, and said no to her. Then I stepped back and yelled for a corpsman. "What's up, Sledgehammer? There's an old gook woman in there that's been hitting the side real bad." "I'll see what I can do for her," he said, as we met about 50 yards from the hut. At that moment, a shot rang out from the hut. I spun around. The corpsman and I went down into a crouching position. "That was an M1, I said. "Sure was." "What the hell?" he said. Just then, a Marine emerged nonchalantly from the hut, checking the safety on his rifle. I knew the man well. He was attached at the time to company headquarters. I called to him by name and said, "Was there a nip in that hut? I just checked it out." "No," he said as we approached him. Just an old gook woman who wanted me to put her out of her misery. So I obliged her. The doc and I stared at each other, and then at the Marine. That quiet, neat, mild-mannered young man just wasn't the type to kill a civilian in cold blood. When I saw the crumpled form under the faded blue kimono in the hut door, I blew up. You dumb bastard! She tried to get me to shoot her, and I called Doc to come help her! The executioner looked at me with a puzzled expression. You son of a bitch, I yelled. If you want to shoot at somebody so damn bad, why don't you trade places with that BAR man or a machine gunner and get out of that damn CP and shoot at Nips? They shoot back. He stammered apologies, and Doc cursed him. I said, we're supposed to kill Nips, not old women. The executioner's face flushed. An NCO came up and asked what happened. Doc and I told him. The NCO glared and said, you dirty bastard. Somebody yelled, let's go, Sledgehammer. We're moving out. You guys shove off. I'll take care of this, said the NCO to Doc and me. We ran off to catch up with the mortar section while the NCO continued to chew out the executioner. I never knew whether or not he was disciplined for his cold-blooded act.
On the right of the 1st Marine Division, the 7th Marines extended its lines to the west coast and sealed off the Oroku Peninsula. Then the 6th Marine Division came in and fought a 10-day battle of attrition to annihilate the Japanese defenders there. The division killed nearly 5,000 Japanese, taking only 200 prisoners, at a loss of 1,608 Marines killed and wounded. On the 4th of June, the 1st Marines relieved the 5th Marines as the assault regiment for the 1st Marine Division's drive to the south. The 5th Marines went into reserve for the 3rd Marine Amphibious Force, a stance that still involved much danger for its weary Marines because of a mission to aggressively patrol and mop up behind the forward elements.
We dug in as a secondary line, along a low ridge with some ruins of Okinawan houses behind us, and a broad, open valley stretching south to our front as far as we could see. The rain ended the night of 5 to 6 June. I'll never forget the sensation of profound physical relief when I removed my soaked, muddy boondockers for the first time in approximately 2 weeks. As I pulled off my slimy, stinking socks, bits and shreds of dead flesh sloughed off the soles of my feet. A buddy, Myron Tessero, commented on the overpowering odor, only to discover that his feet were just as bad. My socks, a pair of khaki-colored, woolen army socks, thicker and heavier than our white Marine Corps issue, were so slimy and putrid I couldn't bear to wash them in my helmet. I had traded a candy bar to a soldier for them back in April. They were my prized possession because of their comfort when wet. With regret, I threw my prized socks aside and spaded dirt over them as though covering up a foul corpse. It was great to wash my feet, holding them up on an ammo box to let the sun shine down on them while I wiggled my toes. Everybody got his feet clean and dry as soon as possible. Mine were extremely sore and red over the entire soles, almost to the point of bleeding. All of the normal friction ridges of the skin had sloughed off, and the soles were furrowed with deep, reddish grooves. But after drying them in the sun and putting on dry socks and boondockers, they soon felt better. Months passed, however, before the soles appeared normal again. We had our mortars set up in pits at the base of the low ridge along which the Company K line was dug in. George Surrett and I had a regular two-man foxhole on the ridge next to a road cut that came through at right angles to the ridge. During the nights we were there, we mortarmen took turns on the guns and fired flares periodically over our company area. Between patrols and nightly vigils, we began to get rested and dried out. We had airdrops of supplies, food, water, and ammo. During the day, we could build campfires and heat rations, which all enjoyed. We had 10-in-1 rations there, always a welcome change from the C&K rations. The method of airdrop used to supply water had not been perfected then. The water was contained in long plastic bags, four of which were stored in a metal cylinder attached to the parachute. Quite often, the impact of the cylinder hitting the deck caused one or more of the bags to break, and some or all of the water in it was lost. We always had a lot of fun when supplies were airdropped to us, even though it was hard work running through the mud, collecting up the ammo, rations, and other supplies attached to the brightly colored chutes. Most of the time, Marine torpedo bombers made the drops while flying low over us. Their accuracy was remarkable. During the periods when deep mud covered much of the battlefield, we always welcomed a clear day, not only because we hated the rain, but because it meant our planes could be up and supply us with airdrops. Otherwise, supplies had to be manhandled miles through the mud. While we were in reserve, another mortarman and I were sent on a routine mission to carry a message to the West Coast regarding supplies. It was the kind of ordinary thing every infantryman was called on to do many times. Typically, it was good duty, because we were temporarily out from under the eagle eye of the company gunny sergeant, could move at our own pace, and do a little sightseeing along the way through areas already fought over and secured. It wasn't considered hazardous. Our instructions were straightforward. Our company gunny, Hank Boys, told us to keep on the main east-west road all the way to the beach and back. He told us who to contact and what to ask for. Then he warned us against screwing around souvenir hunting and cautioned us about the possibility of bypassed enemy. We started off in high spirits for what we thought would be an interesting jaunt into the area south of the Oroku Peninsula. We had gotten cleaned up by then. Our dungarees had been washed, and our leggings and boondockers were dry and scraped clean of mud. We carried the usual 2 canteens of water. We also had rationed chocolate bars because we would be gone several hours and could eat those on the move. My buddy was armed with a carbine. I carried the Tommy and my .45 pistol. The weather had dried out, and it was an ideal day for a little harmless diversion from the patrols we had been making. After we moved out of our battalion area and onto the road, we saw almost no one. As we walked along the silent road, the only sounds in our immediate surroundings were our own voices, the crunching of our boondockers on the road, the muffled sloshing of the water in our canteens, and the occasional thump of our weapons stocks against our canteens or K-bar scabbards. We moved in that silent world that characterized the backwash of battle. The area was replete with the flotsam of war. The storm front had passed, but its wreckage was left behind. Our experienced eyes read the silent signs and reconstructed the drama and pathos of various life and death struggles that had occurred. We encountered numerous enemy corpses, which we always passed on the windward side. We saw no Marine dead, but a bloody dungaree jacket here, a torn boondocker there, a helmet with the camouflage cloth cover and steel beneath ripped by bullets, discarded plasma bottles, and bloody battle dressings gave mute testimony of the fate of their former owners. We passed through an embankment for a railroad track and entered the outskirts of a town. All buildings were badly damaged, but some were still standing. We stopped briefly to explore a quaint little store. Displayed in its window were various cosmetics. In the street in front of the store lay a corpse clad in a blue kimono. Someone had placed a broken door over the pathetic body. We speculated he had been the proprietor of the little shop. We passed a burnt-out bus station with the ticket booth still standing in front. To our right and distant, the battle rumbled and rattled as the 6th Marine Division fought the enemy on the Oroku Peninsula. Without incident, we continued through the ruins toward the beach,